just give an opportunity if anybody new or old has any questions about the practices that they've, if you're new, have seen today or experienced today, or if you're running into any kind of life situation that's not clear how the teachings of mindfulness and Dharma could be beneficial. Please, if anybody has any questions, please feel free to ask at this moment. Don't be shy, even though there are a bunch of people. Good. It's always to sit in the presence of the enlightened ones. Ah, one person willing to admit. Good, you're in the history of Pacha Rinpoche. All he does is admit his defects, so good. Yes.
I'm new.
Good.
And, the three things that I think of in Buddhism is the nons.
The what?
I call them the nons.
The nons.
Nons, non-judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And non-reaction, non-violence,
mm-hmm.
non-attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And three of them I can kind of handle. The non-judgment is pretty obvious. Sometimes, not always.
Mm-hmm.
Non-reaction, non-violence. Non-attachment is my
argument. So that's a big one. So the question is, this gentleman is new today. Obviously, he's been reading something or been aware of Buddhism in other ways, and he's aware that there are a number of nons, like non-judgment, non-violence, non-reaction, which isn't quite, but we'll accept that. And but non-attachment. So I'll just quick and dirty, since we have teaching to go into today. But yeah, that is a and you know, that is always weaving throughout Buddhism, because it goes back to the Buddha himself, because he was concerned with human suffering, and so his whole questioning was to understand, you know, what causes people, human beings, to create suffering for themselves and others, and how to liberate, how to free people from that suffering. And what he discovered as he looked deeply into life, at his own life and around life, that a lot of suffering, again, of all types, from the grossest to the most psychologically subtle, types of suffering, unhappiness, discomfort, dissatisfaction, etc. All comes from attachment. Okay. Now, attachment's an interesting word. It is because often people think attachment, they hear detachment. Now, detachment is a word that perhaps if one is following a monastic path, a celibate monastic path, where you have actually detached from the world, right? You've detached from your hair, you've detached from your sexuality, you've detached from relationships, you've detached from money, you've detached, you know, you really detached, and you actually live apart from. So that's a path. But most of the followers of Buddhism, such as those of us here, are not monastics. We live in the world. So detachment is really not a teaching that's very relevant or meaningful to us. Actually, it could probably get us into a lot of trouble. Right. So what we need to be more concerned about is attachment, which is how, quite simply, we are totally immersed in the world, right? Has anybody noticed that?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are totally immersed in the world. We our eyes see objects, our ears hear sounds, our nose smell, taste, feel, as well as this mind of ours is endlessly generating thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and so it's a world of endless stuff, right? Physical stuff, mental stuff, right? Emotional stuff, right? All that's just endlessly arising, right? That's just the way it is, isn't it? So a teaching around attachment is really about how do I relate to that, right? Not how do I separate from it, or how do I, but how do I skillfully relate to phenomena, to things, physical and mental, internal and external, without a continuation of suffering, right? So is that clear? So what the Buddha noticed is that the suffering is not in the thing, right? The suffering comes from a mind that attaches to the thing. It is the suffering is a mental event, and attachment is a mental it's a mental event, right? You can't see attachment, but you can experience the results of it, right? If I was attached, see, these flowers are just here, right? They are just flowers, right? If I was attached to them, then I could attach to them how? I could attach to them by labeling them my flowers, right? Once I label them my flowers, I am developing a relationship with them, which is primarily about what? About me. Now they're my flowers. Right? So, in a positive way, that could be good, because I might take care of them, care for them, nurture them, right? But that's kind of a healthy, we might say, a healthy kind of attachment, right? But if I attach to them in a way that I love them, and I just want them to stay the way they are, I am attached. They are mine, and I want them to stay the way I want them to stay, right? I am heightening the attachment. You see, you can't see it, but I am attaching to them. They're mine, and I want them to be a certain way. Why? Because I think if they stay the way they are, then I will be what? Happy, right? Now, the problem with that is what?
It's not reality.
That's not reality. Very good. That is why those kinds of thinkings is not only called in Buddhism a misperception, right? But it's called ignorance. It's called stupidity. Because when we stop and look at it, we go, that's crazy, isn't it? That's crazy, Fred. But if Fred was attached, if he made these his, and wanted them always to stay the way he wants them to stay, and as they begin to change, what happens? He begins to get sad, or he gets angry, angry at life, angry at the flowers. He could get angry at anything, right? Also, if I attach to these as mine, right? Then, in other words, they become an extension of myself. Then I could also be very aware of other people and how they're relating to it, right? No one else is really saying how beautiful they are,
yeah.
Right? you see what I'm saying? No one's really making a big deal about them. So I could be, you see, that could also be a sense of, I could be angry, frustrated, hurt, right? How come no one sees how special they are? They're mine. And they're beautiful. So in that way, we can, or let's say people don't ignore it, let's say somebody says, ooh, I hate those flowers. Fred, could you get them out of here? Really, I couldn't concentrate the whole talk, just seeing, could you get them out? I would be what? Affronted. How dare they not see them the way I see them? So that's just a little example of how when you take something that is essentially something in itself and you attach especially when the attachment is also attached to a sense of me and mine, big trouble. Big trouble. And this is just with this. This is... You see what I'm saying? This is tiny. But we do big stuff. We do stuff with my body and my relationship and my job and my the way. Endlessly we attach. And we want all the things that we attach to be the way we want them to be. And the truth is, they're not the way we want them to be. They are what they are. Right? The world is what it is. Anybody notice the world is not the way you want it to be? See, look how wise we are. But yet, because in this moment of kind of stepping back and being here, we go, yeah, of course, it's crazy. And then we go out in the world and we're hurt and frustrated and angry, and right? Because things aren't the way, and the world is not the way we want it to be. So attachment is big, and it manifests in endless ways. We're attached to our thoughts, we're attached to our beliefs, we're attached to our feelings, we're attached to, you know, everything. We're attached to our needs, our wants, everything we attach to. If we're not attached, what happens? They come and go. They're free. But when we attach, there's that... Attachment means there's... When we attach, there has to be control and manipulation. And so if we wonder why our relationship to life is so much like that, it is because of this fundamental attachment. Now again, the answer is, you know, the simple answer is detachment, right? Can you see that's like a simple, one way fits everything kind of answer. I'll just detach from everything. I won't care about anything. Okay? But that's an extreme response. That's not a very wise or intelligent response. Right? You know, again, that would be like, oh yeah, I can see, getting involved with flowers always leads to suffering. Right? Right? You can see, because I could think that there's no other way but attachment or detachment. Right? So I just, oh, flowers, relationships, I'm done with that, right? See, that's a good answer, but then you're stuck with what? No flowers, right? No flowers. So the question is, how can we be in this world where there are flowers, but their blossom is very temporary? If we watch this over these next few days, we would see it slowly begin to not be as lovely, not as vibrant. And eventually it would lose not only its vibrancy, but it would become ugly. Do you know what I'm saying? It would wilt. It would fall off. It would be nothing that you would... But that is the truth, too, of this flower. That is the truth of our body. That is the truth of everything. And so the answer is, how do I relate to the world of flowers, the world of transiency, the world of change, in a way that only creates well-being within me? Right? I can appreciate the flower when it is fully bloomed, and I can appreciate the flower when it's wilting. I understand that's all part of it, right? But yet at the same time, because I am not detached, I can enjoy the flower when it was here, as it's here, and I can water it and take good care of it and trim it up a little bit. Yeah, I can be a good caretaker. So, attachment, non-attachment is tricky, but it is central. So thank you. Any other questions before we return to our teaching? Yes.
The master that you're calling me about, he's critiquing his practice?
Mm-hmm. Seemingly, yes.
Seemingly?
Yes.
So, it seems that we all want to critique our practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, when we critique our practices, it seems that there can be a skillful and accepting way with humor and lightness, and sometimes a way that's not as skillful. And I wonder if you could talk to that.
Sounds like you could talk to that. So Evelyn's said, referring to this teachings from Pachu Rinpoche, advice from me to myself, he seems to be very overtly critiquing his practice and the way he goes about it. And Evelyn says, there seems to be, in one's self-critique of one's practice, how does one do it in a way that is meaningful? But not heavy. Or is there a way to be heavy and light at the same time? Mm-hmm. Which is another. And I think that is. That's it. You see, that's like this, right? How can I, knowing that this is temporary, knowing that this flower will only look like this maybe for one day, right? Can I be very present and caretake it, and yet know, right, that it will not be here long? Right? It's finding that balance, right? In the same way, we say we have this practice, and Pachu Rinpoche talks a lot about practice, and he basically is just slamming himself in every side, right? And yet, at the end of that, he could be laughing, right? Again, a lot of it is because Buddhism, the Buddhist understanding, the psychological understanding of the mind and self, is that the self is a non-self. And that all judgments, all thoughts, or beliefs are just simply temporary, right? They are pricks. They're not deep knife wounds. Right? A prick can just be, kind of wake us up. Right? A knife wound could be something that does significant harm. Right? Last night I walked into the wall. I got up in the middle of the night. I was on my way toward the bathroom. There's a little turn there, and in my kind of sleepy state, all of a sudden, the light in when I'd gone to bed, I had seen that the light in the parking area, which can be seen from our bedroom, it's one of those automatic lights, was not working. So I got up in the night, and as I was wending my sleepy way, all of a sudden I remembered that. And I thought, I'll just kind of look over. I didn't think about it. I just kind of looked over to see whether the light was on, wasn't smart enough to stop walking. So when I looked and it was on, I turned back, bang. Now, fortunately, right, it was enough of a bang to kind of wake me up. But it wasn't a severe enough bang to do any damage. It was a good bang. Right? It was a helpful bang. But it didn't. It wasn't a harmful bang. I think that's the trick, right? How can we? Again, the gentleman said. Non-judgment, and yet there has to be judgment, right? I mean, when I'm driving, I have to judge the performance. You know, am I in the lane or not in the lane, right? Am I observing, observing the speed limit? So there has to be judgment generally in life, self-awareness, and if we are walking a spiritual path, which is a little can be very subjective, right? One has to be able to somewhat step back and be somewhat aware about one's efforts, how one's doing or not doing, how one did or didn't do. And yet, how does one do it in a way that is not about me, See, it's not about the kind of person I am. It doesn't tap into all that shame, guilt, stuff that Americans seem to be so accomplished at. There's not a lot of that in Buddhism at all, actually. Shame and guilt. Because it comes at the mind and the self in very different ways than the Western mind. So all we could say is, you know, can one look at oneself and see one has qualities, characteristics, someone thinks are helpful or beneficial to oneself, and some are not. And one can just look at that very objectively, without a lot of self involved, without a lot of drama, and kind of work with oneself in a good way. I mean, the same way one, if one is working with a puppy to train it, right? One can do it in a very, right? You don't have to be heavy, do you? You don't have to be negative toward the animal. Right? Because you understand what? It's a puppy. It doesn't know better. And my job is what? Just to try to train it up. Right? That's all. It doesn't have to be an onerous, heavy duty, nor does it have to be very judgmental or personal, right? So because there's understanding and there's compassion and and that produces a lightness. Right, so one can be involved in something, you know, like training a puppy, like training a child, right? You know, teachers. Anybody here a teacher? Yeah, so, right? If one is a good teacher, one can love one's students. One can be very desirous of wanting to help them, right? Develop, and one in that pedagogic process knows that it involves not only praise, but sometimes we have to be a little critical, right? We have to kind of, you know, they can't get A's for everything. That wouldn't be very helpful to them, right? So when they are performing below the mark, we want to be able to work with them, don't we, and help them. But we don't have to put them down. We don't have to make it about them. We don't have to make them feel bad. We don't have to make them ashamed. I mean, it may be a little shame if they got a D on the test because they didn't study, right? You want to be able to say, you know, it wasn't good. You got to study. You know, you don't study, you get D's, right? But it doesn't have to be about them. They're bad people. There's something wrong with them. It can be done in understanding. Is that clear? So, you know, a lot of people have issues about themselves, feeling unworthy, less than, they bring shame, they have shame and guilt, and just a very punitive inner dialogue, critical of themselves, which is really unworthy. We are human beings. There is something wonderful in that. Every one of us has the potential, at least in Buddhism, we say. Well, I mean, Buddhism says this. It's not just only people in Buddhism, but I mean, Buddhism says every one of us has the potential for Buddhahood. Right? Which means every one of us, just as we are, no matter how screwed up we are, or how screwed up we've been, or what we've done, or whatever, all of us have this potential for transformation, for awakening, and for manifesting in all the positive qualities that we could ever imagine. So that is who we are. Not to know that, or at least believe it, is doing great damage. Because if we do not see that inherent potential for transformation, for goodness, and that that is truly who and what we are, then it is very easy to be self-indulgent in all kinds of negative and toxic kind of mind states and activities and behaviors, and you know, that in no way befit who and what we really are. The real message of the Buddha was that everyone is a Buddha. I mean, that's what he said in his enlightenment. And he was dumbstruck. He was dumbstruck because he was like us. He had led a conditioned life. He thought he was Siddhartha. He was such and such and such and such. And he was born here and died there, and you know. And when he came to his great enlightenment, he realized that he was so much more. And that was always there. There was nobody to point it out to him. He had to point it out for himself. That is why when Marilyn said we bow to the Buddha, and again, this is just a statue of the Buddha. This is not the golden calf that we are praying to. If anybody is thinking that. This is a representation of the Buddha. The Buddha, the capacity of all of us to awaken, to be a Buddha. And it's an acknowledgement that at least in our world system, historically, the Buddha was the one who discovered this wonderful truth. So as opposed to him, we don't have to kind of make it up on our own, you know, figure it out on our own. There is a path that clearly elaborates the truths that we're talking about, the inherent potential that all of us had for awakening, and that we all have the seed of Buddhahood in us that only has to be nurtured and nourished, which is why we practice. And because we practice in this way, with this type of aspiration, you know, we need to be somewhat self-aware. The other thing, you know, Evelyn, is we are often, in a certain way, this kind of seems paradoxical, but in a certain way, like Pachu Rinpoche, we have to be able to be very kind of objective about ourselves and take a dispassionate look and be willing to not be hypocritical or be phonies and really call ourselves on our stuff. But at the same time, interestingly enough, and sounds paradoxical, we are often not the best judge of ourselves, right? Because of our stuff. And because, you know, we are so identified with ourselves, it's hard to get outside enough to be objective about it. So that is why it's important historically in Buddhism, for those who are practicing Buddhism more than just a kind of religion, right? But actually at the path of transformation, which is the way the Buddha taught it. That we have, you know, that we work with mentors, that we work with teachers. In the same way, we do that. You know, we go to school, we have teachers, we have mentors. If we're learning a craft, if we're learning a profession, we have people who mentor us, right? And hopefully a good mentor is somebody who gives us objective feedback. So therefore, if we are solely relying on our own judgment, it could be flawed. Right? So it's good to have this kind of self-awareness, but it's also good to have mentors, someone else to kind of hold up the mirror, shine the light. Right? Because often we are not clear. We are not clear of how we are practicing. But oftentimes we are clouded by our own stuff, our own conditioning, our own issues. So we are not aware of so much more can be done because we have such a limited... I was just talking to somebody a few days ago. I mean, just kind of presented this list of all this, all the junk they've been involved in their whole life. You know, fairly well said and insightful. And at the end of it, you know, their sense was, you know, and this is my cross to bear. Right? And hopefully through meditation and other things, it can make it a little lighter. But essentially, you know, this is my cross to bear. This is my burden in this life. And I said, that's nonsense. I said, you know, were you born like that? You know, were you born with all those issues? No. Oh, so before there was a you before you had issues. Oh, well, that's interesting. So there was something there before the issues developed. So they are not permanently part of you, right? I mean, if you were born with all your issues, then you can make a good case that they're you. But if you understand that there was a you, whatever we are, before there were any issues, and that the issues developed over time, and the issues, when we look back, we can see how they developed in the context in which they developed, it's very clear that they are just something that came about. Right? According to causes and conditions, they're not permanent. You know, and when the person said, they had this issue, a big issue, I said, right now, do you have that issue? You know, this is what we were talking together. I said, right now, do you have that issue? He said, no. Well, then I said, then it's really not with you all the time, is it? Well, that's interesting. So where is that issue right now? He couldn't find it. Well, then it shows that it just arises again according to causes and conditions. So anything that is impermanent, anything that only arises to causes and condition, and anything that wasn't there from the original manifestation of who and what we are, is certainly something that is temporary. I mean, that sounds revolutionary, right? That all our stuff. And maybe it seems like so serious because we take it so seriously, because we are so identified with it. We think that's us. You know, I am my issues. But we are so much more than our issues. Any other questions? Yes, Susan.
In the guided meditation this morning, and often in meditations, the instruction is to relax into various parts of your body. And what I wonder is, if one is experiencing ill health in some mm-hmm. parts, how mm-hmm. does one do that?
Mm-hmm. When we say relax, let's say a physical relaxation, it is acknowledging that whatever is going on, our relationship to it can be one of non-attachment and openness. Right? Whether it is physical sensations, whether it is mental, emotional, right? Whatever it is, if we are grasping, if we are attaching, if we are doing all that kind of stuff, right, it is a situation that becomes appears very solid and real and intensifies what's going on. So therefore, this capacity to relax, you know, and not just as a relaxation exercise. You know, many of us say, oh yeah, I know how to relax. Parentheses, when I do my relaxation exercises. No. We want to be able to cultivate a relaxed ease of body and mind all the time. That is our natural mind. It's only we just keep ramping it up all the time. With what? With our attachments. So when we do a physical relaxation, where we're just saying, be aware, be relaxed and aware. So even if you come to a part of the body that is in distress, in that moment, your relationship to it is very open and spacious, not grasping, not making a big deal about it. It just is what it is, which is what it is at the end of the day. So this capacity of relaxation is a very key aspect of practice. You know, to be at ease in the meditative tradition, the great perfections, and you hear a lot about a mind at ease, about going through life with a mind and body where there's a great sense of ease. That's something we want to cultivate. It is the opposite of a mind that is always agitated, a mind that always is filled with drama and melodrama, a mind that is always upset about this or that. Right? That is not a mind that's at ease, is it? No. Why is the mind not at ease? Because we are stirring it up. Why are we stirring it up? Because we are attached. We don't like the way things are going in the world. We don't like what somebody said to us, or didn't say to us, or should have said to us, or right? We don't like any of that. So we get ourselves agitated because we are attached to the way we want things to be, how we want people to be, how we want to be treated, how things should be unfolding for us. Right? We are not relaxed. And again, relaxed doesn't mean you're a doormat. Relaxed doesn't mean, oh, you know, come trot on me. Right? Kick me around, have a good time. It doesn't mean that. We should spend a little time with Patrick Rinpoche.